Greetings, toons and goons, and welcome to another badly drawn episode of Junk Food Cinema, brought to you by FilmSchoolReject.com. That's a new one. You're changing it up on me. I can't get a beat on you, and I'm okay.
You're not
with
supposed to. I zag. You have no idea where I'm going to come at you.
You are like a living cartoon, so that makes total sense given this week's episode. This is, of course,
I'm half cartoon on my father's side.
Again, not arguing. I totally see it. This is, of course, the weekly cult and exploitation film cast. So good, it just has to be.
It just has to mumble and stumble and fuck up the thing you actually fucking say every goddamn week for 5 years.
It just has to give me an aneurysm, apparently. I was trying to say that I am your host, Brian.
.com.
Fuck it. I'm done. Brian Salisbury, he's C. Robert Cargill, he's a lieutenant of Megaforce, and this is Junk Food Cinema. Everybody on the same page now? We good?
We're good.
Good. Anyway, we, of course, can be found. All of this, by the way, the professionalism that you just heard, second to none, can all be found in the past. iTunes, Blog Talk Radio,
.com.
You can follow us on Twitter, at junkfoodcinema.
.com.
Like the podcast on Facebook.
.com/junkfoodcinema.
Jesus Christ. You can also go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema if you would like to financially support more of this happening. Obviously, this is something that needs to continue. We have all of the cultural staying power of the Baja Men, and I am happy to say that you can keep the show going.
No, we said we were not making that joke.
Oh, I'm sorry. We are not making that joke. I didn't say that. You can just go back and erase that from time. Patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. You get the idea. Summer of 88 is the thing we are actually here to do today, and I am excited because we are talking about a movie that was very important to a young Brian and is probably the movie that when I was a kid of 1988 was the most important to me, and that is, of course, Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Mommy's going to the beauty parlor, darling. But I'm leaving you with your favorite friend, Roger. He's going to take very, very good care of you. Because if he doesn't, he's going back to the science lab.
Cut!
What the hell was wrong with that take?
Nothing with you, baby Herman. You were great. You were perfect. You were better than perfect. Just Roger. He keeps blowing his lines.
This is the tale of an up-and-coming movie star named Roger Rabbit and a down-and-out private detective named Eddie Valiant.
Ooga booga!
Every moment they were together was a new adventure in trouble.
Hide me, Eddie! Please!
It's a motion picture about friendship.
Eddie, get easy, will ya? Please, Eddie! Don't tell me you're making a big mistake!
Love. Compassion.
Well, I'm sorry I yanked your ears.
All the time you yanked my ears?
Murder.
Marvin Acme. The rabbit cacked him last night.
Remember, you never saw me.
Sex.
I'd do anything for my husband, Mr. Valiant. Anything.
And violence.
Toons gets him every time.
It's a comedy a little different from all the rest.
I'm a pig!
I'm a toon!
I'm not bad. I'm just drawn that way.
But tell me, Eddie, is that a rabbit in your pocket or are you just happy to see me?
Touchstone Pictures and Steven Spielberg present a Robert Zemeckis film.
We toons may act idiotic, but we're not stupid.
Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Well, it's Who Framed Roger Rabbit? Because there is no question mark.
That's true.
No question mark. It is just
Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Well, yeah, because in Hollywood, putting a question mark at the end of a movie is kind of seen as the kiss of death. Like, it is something you're not supposed to do. It's
really
just one of those. It's just Hollywood lore. Like, it's just you don't do it.
Like Lore Lenny or Lore Flynn Boyle? Is that Hollywood lore as well? Is that not what we're talking about? I'm very confused. Yeah, so it's
.com. Like, if Meryl is not dropping that in, Meryl is fired.
Yeah, and if people aren't unsubscribing from this podcast every time we do it, they should be fired from themselves as well. Yes, no, Who Framed Roger Rabbit? So I guess without putting the question mark, it's like the man who shot Liberty Valance. It's, it's more of a clause, a descriptive clause, than it is a question.
Sure.
So we're talking about the person who framed Roger Rabbit.
An adaptation, oddly enough.
An adaptation that...
of a book called Who Censored Roger Rabbit.
And funny enough, that story censored quite a bit in order to be released as a Robert Zemeckis-directed, Steven Spielberg-produced movie produced by Touchstone, which is a Disney offshoot. However, is not really a movie for kids, even though I watched it a lot as a kid.
I disagree. It's very much an 80s-style movie for kids, in which, while it is for kids... there's a lot of subtle stuff for adults, but it's never too over the top.
I don't know. I think there are pretty overt references. I mean, this is a film noir with cartoon characters, and I feel like there are overt references to the seedier things that used to identify film noir. In fact, I watched the trailer for this movie. In the trailer, it says things like, a wholesome family movie with lots of this, this, and then it goes, and sex, and violence. And I'm like... okay, they knew what they were selling.
Sure, but that was very much, again, of the 80s. I mean, keep in mind, this is a movie released, what, two, three years after Goonies, in which Thanos, or not Thanos, actually, but in which one of the gross teen boys is looking down the shirt of one of the girls. Like, this is, in this era, in the 80s, we had just come out of the 70s, and there was this whole concept of, oh, yeah, no, kids are totally fine with, we can talk to kids about sex now. Like, kids, we don't have to keep them totally pure.
Sure.
We would only swing back into film conservatism starting in the 90s and getting into the aughts and where we are now, where people are like, oh my God, I can't believe you'd put that in a kid's movie.
Right.
You know, it's so rare that we even see PG movies anymore because everything is rated PG-13 because it's very hard to get that PG rating.
Yeah. And we mentioned this is based on a book by Gary K. Wolf called Who Censored Roger Rabbit that was actually written in 1981. And as soon as it was written, the attempt to bring it to the screen began. And one of the first people who tried to bring this to the screen was Robert Zemeckis. He tried to come aboard as the director when Disney initially optioned the rights to the book in 1982, but he was turned down because at that time he'd only directed used cars.
Yeah.
And Disney didn't see him as a bankable director. Now, by the time it rolled around again in the late 80s, oh, suddenly he had made a little movie called Back to the Goddamn Future.
With who?
With Steven Spielberg.
Who would go on to produce this, correct?
Yes, yes.
This is very important because we have just... gone through this again, and I find this really fascinating. Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
I don't know.
Is the 1980s version of Ready Player One.
It really is.
It is a movie as much about telling a classic story, a story that you are that you are so familiar with that it is pretty much rote. Who Framed Roger Rabbit, if you strip out all of the references, the noir of Who Framed Roger Rabbit is cliche as fuck, which is the point. That's entirely the point. It is something that, like, me and Scott talk about a lot, in which every mainstream property needs to be 75% familiar and 25% new. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, because if you go too new, audiences don't know what to make of it. They, you know, you look at something like Cool World, and Cool World is so radical, playing around with these same concepts, that that audience is just like, I don't fucking get it. I thought this was going to be like Roger Rabbit. I don't understand. Whereas, you know, if you go, you don't have enough new, then it's boring, and we've seen it before. So you want to throw in that level of new. And the new here is, let's tell the standard tropes, but then let's see what happens when those tropes run headlong into a world where we are connected to cartoons. Yeah. And how do cartoons interact with the world? How do they deal with the world? And wrestles with that. It's very much like what happened with Ready Player One, which Ready Player One optioned before the book came out, optioned before the studio had even read it. There's interesting backstory stuff with that, in which they read the first draft of the script and they're like, you know, this is really good, but what's up with all these movie references?
up with the very thing
that's like, that's the book.
Yeah.
So yeah, this is one of those things where it was, this was a book that was playing around with, hey, let's take all this pop culture I grew up with and kind of put it all together.
Right.
And that's exactly what Ernie Cline ended up doing with Ready Player One, that Steven Spielberg would then go on to adapt his own version, you know, and make that version of the book, which, of course, the movie also deviates from the book as well, but not as much as here. Like,
oh,
the,
my goodness,
the
yeah.
concept of who censored Roger Rabbit is that Roger Rabbit was murdered. And the interesting thing is that Roger Rabbit had done a cartoonish thing and had actually split himself off to run an errand as a gag. And then Roger Rabbit got killed. And so his
doppelganger,
is there waiting, you know, trying to solve the murder before he crumbles to dust.
See, that's the thing is in the universe of the book is it is modern day, but it's a weird parallel universe where humans live alongside comic strip characters. These weren't cartoon characters. They were in the original book. They were comic strip characters who literally talked in word bubbles. And what happens is they all had the ability to create doppelgangers who could do various things for them, but they only had 3 days before they would crumble into dust. So yes, Roger Rabbit is murdered and his doppelganger is trying it. That is, to me, a really interesting concept for any film noir, is somebody who
Classic dead on arrival. Like, it's, okay. You have 24 hours to solve your own murder. Like, that is again a classic noir trope.
And from there, the writers of the actual movie, there are still a lot of differences between the original draft of this screenplay and what ended up on the screen. Like, apparently, the original version was going to have Jessica Rabbit and Baby Herman as the villains. And then they created this character of Judge Doom. And Judge Doom was supposed to have a giant cartoon vulture that sat on his shoulder the entire movie, which was cut because they couldn't figure out the logistics of it. And he was also going to carry around a briefcase full of 12 kangaroos that served as his jury. So anytime he wanted to dispense justice,
because it was a kangaroo court. That's adorable.
And what would happen? It gets more adorable because apparently every kangaroo in her pouch had a little Joey that would hold up the letters of either guilty or not guilty. Like, each one would have a letter. And I'm like, that's adorable until you realize that, like, the final draft where guilty means they are slowly dipped into acetate until they are boiled alive. It's not quite as cute, but, you know, that's the thing I think is really important to talk about. It's not just the seedier stuff and the very sexy Jessica Rabbit and the really hard-boiled noir story.
I don't like the way you said that.
It very sexy Jessica Rabbit. I don't care. Jessica Rabbit was probably my first crush as a kid, so I'm just going to leave it at that. But on the other hand, you also have some stuff that, even as a kid when I watched and loved this movie, scared the fuck out of me. And Judge Doom, high up on that list. So, yeah. So, in the film version, Roger Rabbit is a popular cartoon star who's starting to have some trouble at work, and the head of the studio, R.K. Maroon, what a maroon, get it? He's decided that what's going on is that Roger Rabbit's personal issues are affecting his work, and so he hires a down-and-out private eye named Eddie Valiant, played by the legendary, the unfortunately late Bob Hoskins,
who, by the way, gives one of the best performances of his career.
Absolutely agree.
The thing about this movie and the thing to really marvel at is we have now, here 30 years later, seen this was a groundbreaking film, you know, in terms of how much interaction there was with the animated characters. But we have seen 30 years of people interacting with completely CG characters, and you would be hard pressed to find a single actor who gives a performance as nuanced and as immersed as Bob Hoskins does. There's the moment that just melts my brain, is that when he is there watching Jessica Rabbit for the first time and his jaw drops, and you've got Betty Boop, who comes over and just closes his jaw.
Yeah.
And he does it in a way where he doesn't change his expression. So it really looks like this animated character is pushing his jaw up. Like, the performance he gives, the way he interacts, there's only one small bit in this movie that you can really see the strings on, which is when Roger Rabbit is jumping around inside his jacket. That really does look like a mechanical thing. Aside from that one moment, every moment he interacts with cartoon characters, you fucking believe it, because Bob Hoskins makes you fucking believe it. It is amazing how well he does with this movie.
And that's the same can be said for all of the actors in this movie, but so much more of it is on Bob Hoskins' shoulders because he is at the forefront of the movie. And this movie really did melt brains when it came out, because it's not something that had never been seen before. I mean, of course, there's the great, is it Fred Astaire or Gene Kelly?
Gene Kelly and Jerry.
And Jerry
Tom
the
and
Mouse.
Jerry.
But I mean, that's one scene of a movie. This was an entire...
Yeah, but that was them. What was amazing there is watching them dance together and the moves looking the same and it looking together. That wasn't them having conversations or fights or physically interacting.
Yeah, having, like, Jerry never touches Gene Kelly at any point.
And it's not a full movie.
Like, this really was groundbreaking. I mean, this got them a special Oscar. Like, they literally dedicated a special Oscar to the effects work in this movie. Not a special effects. Like, it was literally just, we're inventing an Oscar to give you for the achievement of this movie because we've never seen anything like it. And... what I find so interesting about, you know, you mentioned Ready Player One, and of course, we're talking about this in the wake of Infinity War, and this is the third week in a row that I'm going to talk about ambitious crossovers, because you have Disney characters and you have Warner Brothers characters in a move that nobody thought would be possible, sharing the screen. And when I say sharing the screen, I mean literally sharing it, and we'll get to that in a moment. But I want to talk, you said no other actor who could have been as nuanced, and I agree with you, but that's not for lack of trying. Because apparently the number one choice, do you want to take just a flying guess?
No, I actually know who it is. So.
The number one choice for this role was Harrison Ford, but his asking price was too high.
Oh, see, I didn't know that was the number, because the number one choices that I saw was a different number one choice.
Was it Bill Murray?
Yes.
Okay, funny enough, when we did our Beetlejuice episode, I conflated this story because Bill Murray was also in the running for Beetlejuice. And I said that what happened was that they couldn't get a hold of him. That's not the case. It was this movie. It was Eddie Valiant. He was doing this weird idiosyncratic method of receiving roles. He didn't want to have direct Hollywood ties. He didn't have a way to really get a hold of him in the late 80s.
Is this the old way? Is this the way he's still doing now?
He might still be doing it now.
Where he fired his agent and he set up a 1-800 number?
Pretty much. And they just...
No, he's still doing that. In fact, he often talks about he'll get calls out of the blue from Wes Anderson. And it'll be, "Hi, Bill, it's Wes. I've got a new role for you. I'd love to make another movie with you. So if you've got my number, please call me back." Like, he literally gets on an answering machine.
That is hilarious. And so Bill Murray was the next in line. And then Eddie Murphy. Eddie Murphy turned it down. But Bill Murray didn't find out till years later that he was even in the running for Eddie Valiant because of this weird way that he was accepting roles.
Yeah.
But let me do a quick speed round of everybody else who was in the running.
Oh, wait. Hold on. Before we get there, Bill Murray, who would then go on to play Garfield the Cat. Have you ever heard a story about why he played Garfield the Cat?
No.
Because he was sent the script, and the script is by Joel Cohen. And
oh, no.
He thought it was by that Joel Cohen and not a different Joel Cohen. And so he was like, "Well, if it's a Cohen Brothers script, I'm sure there's something I'm not seeing here." So he signed the contract to do two movies. Because that he thought it was an Ethan and Joel Cohen Garfield movie.
I mean,
that fact kills me.
Not to tell you your business, Bill Murray, this is why you might want to have an agent.
Agents, not such bad things.
Not
sometimes.
A terrible thing. Quick, Jürgen, pause now. Jaunt to the sidebar.
Jürgen, pause now.
I will never get over the weird, weird, the cat in the Matrix situation of Bill Murray voicing Garfield when Lorenzo Music, who did the voice of Garfield in the animated show, went on to voice Bill Murray's character on the Ghostbusters cartoon.
I know.
Still melts my fucking... guys crisscrossing.
That's always been linked
crazy.
In my head.
Fucking crazy. All right, so speed round. Everybody else who was in the running for Eddie Valiant. Chevy Chase. Robert Redford. Jack Nicholson, which actually makes a lot of sense considering a lot of this movie feels like Chinatown if it had cartoon characters in it. Stallone, possibly the weirdest one coming up, Wallace Shawn, Ed Harris.
Wallace Shawn would have been great.
Charles Grodin and Don Lane.
Yeah, that sounds like exactly who you get in 1988. But you know what? No one in that list makes as interesting a movie as as what we got.
This is
like,
true.
Like, seriously, there's Bob Hoskins is Eddie Valiant, and I don't see any way that any of them could have been. Like, seriously, Harrison Ford would not have gotten the comedy the way that it needed to be.
Cartoons everywhere.
The best thing, though, I now have headcanon of Harrison Ford giving Roger Rabbit the finger of doom.
Yep.
But
it's after he's attacked by the weasels and gets animated. So it's like, whoop, finger of doom.
The problem, like Eddie Murphy, terrible choice. I see why they wanted Eddie Murphy, but Eddie Murphy would not have wanted to play the straight man. His version of playing a straight man is going even broader. And like, that's the thing that works about Bob Hoskins is half this movie, you think he's going to murder Roger Rabbit. And that's fucking great. Yeah. Like, it makes it work. Yeah, it's there, but there's nobody else in that list. Like, I could see why they thought Charles Grodin, but Charles Grodin doesn't have the pathos to carry that. Like, yeah, there's nobody in that list that does as well or would have made a movie that'd be like, yeah, I kind of want to slip into that alternate universe and see what that's like. No. Hoskins was the way to go.
Who can we get that has the angry, grizzled sadness of a down and out private eye from the most hard-boiled era of noir, but also can do great physical comedy and be a huge presence? Like, that's Bob Hoskins.
Yeah.
He was born to play this fucking role.
He really was. And in fact, I think it is going to go down as his most well-known role. And it is the role that 50 years from now, people will still be watching.
Agreed.
But going back to the ambitious crossover.
Yes.
Let's talk about this crossover for a minute, because it is both awesome and awkward at times. Like, the fact that they did it was great. Getting to see certain characters on screen at the same time, great. Getting to have them interact, fantastic. But there were some odd stipulations put on it and some odd choices made. So, of course, the big stipulations were all the big characters had to have equal screen time, which is why they appear at the same time. Mm-hmm. It's why Bugs and Mickey are skydiving together. It's why Daffy. Now, probably the best part of the movie in terms of nostalgia is seeing Daffy and
Donald Duck
go at each other, because that
literal dueling pianos.
It is the best use of any of those characters. And then there's a lot of odd characters that are put in. And I wanted to bring up the oddest one.
Okay.
Because I had never noticed this until this most recent viewing. Dear God, Tar Baby is in this movie.
No.
Tar Baby appears in this movie, and
I never noticed that.
I caught it this way. I was like, wait, no. And I ran it back, and I was like, holy fuck balls. When Eddie first enters Toontown, and you look over to the side, and there's this row of rabbits sitting on the end, is Tar Baby holding a sign saying, "Visit the La Brea Tar Pits."
Jesus, God in heaven, I never noticed that.
And there's kind of a beautiful symmetry to it, because it seems to be, it feels like, because you only see him like in a blurred window.
Mm-hmm.
And you can make him out, but there's no good clean shot of him. There's no big shot of him. And I feel like it may have been a nod to the one thing they couldn't put into this film, which is, in this particular era, all of our cartoons were racist as fuck.
Yeah.
And that not every single cartoon, but all of the companies had racist shit in it. And like,
well, let's think about the company that's backing this movie.
Yes.
Disney, who in Dumbo have literal Jim Crows.
Yeah.
Like, that's fucked up.
Yeah, and they don't show up in the movie.
No, Dumbo does. But not the Jim Crows.
Not them. But Tar Baby, which was a Disney character from Song of the South, a film with so much wrong with it, mm-hmm, that not only is it not available on DVD, but Harry Knowles has screened it publicly. That's how inappropriate it is. I was really kind of blown away that was that. It was like,
man,
oh,
I never noticed that.
Fuck. And I was just like, that's kind of weird. But it is, I mean, that's the thing, is there's some, like, if like, but you mentioned that. You mentioned the Jim Crows. There is a Warner Brothers cartoon called Coal Black, which is a version of Snow White. It's Coal Black and the Seven Dwarves.
God, no.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, it is. You can find it on YouTube. If you can stomach, like,
I will not be looking
deep-seated racism, if you could to look it back and see it as Warner Brothers does often talk about it through historical perspective. Pretending it doesn't exist is like saying it never happened, and that's horseshit.
No,
like, it is probably the most racist thing I've ever seen, and it's Warner Brothers cartoon. I think it might actually be A Merry Melodies. I can't remember if it is or not, but it is. It is probably the most offensive mainstream cartoon that I've ever seen. And so this movie pretends that doesn't exist, except they do drop in a very subtle coal baby. And that might be Zemeckis and the animating crew, you know, kind of slipping that in and going, hey, we can't acknowledge how fucked up this era was in cartoons. So let's just slip in a little, hey, there's that, and people will recognize it.
Sure.
So that may be what it is, but yeah, it kind of disturbed me for a moment seeing Tar Baby there.
Yeah, no, I never noticed that, and that is, that's crazy.
This whole thing's a setup, a scam, a frame job.
Also want to talk about a guy who doesn't get a lot of credit for this movie, because you don't see him ever, is Charles Fleischer, who does the voice of Roger Rabbit, who, by the way, you may not know this, is a JFC alum. He was in Nightmare on Elm Street. He was in Nightmare on Elm Street. He was in Demon Knight, and he's in Back to the Future Part 2. So he's Wally in Demon Knight, the guy who looks like the guy who voices Roger Rabbit.
Yeah.
One thing I didn't know, however, was during the animation tests, it was Paul Reubens who voiced Roger Rabbit, and Charles Fleischer was just kind of in the suit as the sort of Andy Serkis type. Like, just kind of being there on set and being in the outfit literally to give people a point of reference. And then they ended up going with Fleischer as well for the voice performance. He also does the voice of the cab and two of the weasels. So it's pretty impressive what he did in this movie. And of course, Kathleen Turner as the voice of Jessica Rabbit.
Yes.
Who I've already mentioned was my earliest crush in my entire life. Like, Jessica Rabbit, who is not bad, she's just drawn that way, is basically like if the male id could form a hand and draw what a woman should look like. It's like this bizarre sort of unobtainable human standard. Like, her proportions are completely ridiculous.
Well, yeah, because if you actually saw a woman that looked that way,
it would be terrifying.
It would be terrifying. Like, that is, like, there's literally a moment where he bends over to pick up his pants and then bumps her head on her boobs.
Yeah.
Like, in a such a ridiculous fashion, but because they're literally, like, 3 feet from her ass. Like, it is. But it's really interesting.
That's very true.
It's really interesting because there's that moment when you're in the bar and you first see Jessica Rabbit, and then you're looking at black and white Betty Boop, and Betty Boop and Jessica Rabbit, both such mutants that men have been turned on by forever because they're drawn. It's kind of like, you know, anime girls with big eyes. Like, if you've ever seen anybody try to make that in real life, holy shit, is it terrifying?
Yeah, for sure.
It's like, you know,
like trying to bring Homer Simpson to life. I don't want that.
Or a Bratz doll where it's just like, oh my God, burn it with fire. kill it with fire.
By the way, speaking of kill it with fire, apparently Charles Fleischer was in the running to play Palmer in The Thing. So that's a little bit of it, which makes sense that he would kind of cross over again, because who shot this movie? Dean Cundey. Dean Cundey, who shot Back to the Future, and all pretty, not all, but most of John Carpenter's best movies are shot by Dean Cundey, who, again, the Junk Food Cinema Hall of Fame has a spot ready for him.
Yeah, no, and in fact, the cinematography in this movie is something that doesn't get enough credit, because if you pay close attention, there is very controlled camera work going on when there's only animated characters on screen.
Yeah.
So you are tracking with animated characters. They knew exactly what these characters were going to do. They knew what camera movements they wanted. This is a very precisely made movie. And the cinematography is so integral to getting those animated characters to feel like they're really there in a movie and not on static shots cutting back and forth, as would have been easier. That's the thing about it, is yeah. what they did was hard, but it made it feel like a real fucking movie and like they're really there.
And I think Cundy really sinks his teeth into the wet streets, and when it's daylight, it's always dusk in the city of Los Angeles. Like, your go-to visual language for a film noir, he is really sinking his teeth into, because there are big swaths of this movie where, especially when Eddie goes to Toontown, where, and I've seen the side-by-sides, like, it is him in a green set. Like, it is like if you've ever seen them shoot any of the prequels. It looks like that, but with a purpose. So you're watching, like, Eddie just interact with almost nothing, like with X's on poles or, like, one physical object, like a cab door. And I feel like you're right. There's a lot of tracking that's done in scenes with just animated characters. So Cundy is taking the time to make sure that the movement through a scene still is visually appealing, despite the fact that they're going to have to digitally insert the people who occupy that space later on. Like, it's actually a lot to ask of a cinematographer, and I think he absolutely knocks it out of the park, as does the composer on this movie, longtime Zemeckis collaborator, Alan Silvestri.
Yeah.
Like, this is the score I think of when I think of Alan Silvestri. When I have to, in my head, think of what is an Alan Silvestri score sound like, I think of Who Framed Roger Rabbit. It's got his tinkling on the xylophone and his, like, very kind of almost like if an orchestra had Tourette's. Like, there's just like a like it's a lot of, like, blasts of music and then, like, very subtle, like, ominous tinkling on a xylophone. Like, that's Alan Silvestri. And if you ever want to hear, like, I can now identify a few different composers before their names even come up on the screen if I hear their music. And Silvestri's one, Horner's another one. And it's this movie that kind of put that exemplar in my head. So it's definitely among his very best scores. And I like how he incorporates the kind of, like, sexy saxophone into it as well. It's like, just drive home the hard-boiled nature of the detective story. Like, it's so, everything about this movie is so well put together. Like, everyone is aware that they are making something that has never been done before, even as they are beholden to a genre that has been around at that point for 40, 50 years.
I want to talk about something that I don't like about this movie, though.
Go for it.
The one problem I have with this movie, because we're about to get into, because everything else about this movie, I'm going to say straight up, is perfect. Because structurally speaking, storytelling wise, this is a perfect movie. The one thing I don't think is perfect, the one thing that bothers me every time I watch it, is when the movie opens, we open with that cartoon. And that cartoon is just a bad cartoon.
Yeah.
Like, it's really not a good cartoon. Like, it's supposed to be a representation of what cartoons were in that era. And it's like, it goes to show how talented those people making those cartoons really were, because they, even some of those older films, they're doing something interesting. They're doing great stuff. Characters are making interesting choices. And here it's literally just an animated version of Baby's Day Out.
Yeah.
But Roger doesn't actually make choices that get him into bad things. He just starts running, and then it's literally just watching him get beat up. Like, it's practically Passion of the Christ in animated form, where it's just...
Who crucified Roger Rabbit?
Where it's just literally, like, it's just watching him get beat up, but not in a way, like, with Itchy and Scratchy, that's a great parody of Tom and Jerry, to where it's, like, going to an extent of going...
The big extreme violence
and satirizing it. But it is structurally like a Tom and Jerry cartoon without having the moments that make Tom and Jerry so interesting. Tom and Jerry, also two characters surprisingly absent from this movie. I feel like that was like the one missed opportunity of this movie, is we don't have that studio. We don't have the Hanna-Barbera stuff. with mixing them up. Not that this needed more of that, but I felt like Tom and Jerry, since that opening so rips it off, kind of should have been here. And it's and I'm guessing it's purely rights issues. But yeah, I felt like that's the one part of the movie that always bothers me, where I'm like, this cartoon should be better. It should be funnier, because these characters, once you get them out of the cartoon, are both fucking hilarious. Roger Rabbit is just great. The stuff they do with cartoons all throughout the entire movie is fantastic. They really understand the Tooniverse and the laws of cartoons and what makes them funny. And it's all really well done.
I would even call them masters of the Tooniverse.
Yes. That might be great.
That might be great. If I didn't know what jokes were, that might be great.
That might be funny. But yeah, but that's the one part that always bugs me, is every time I watch this movie, it's like, oh, I really don't like this cartoon.
Well,
and everything else is great.
I agree with you. I think, if I'm kind of retconning a little bit, I think the idea behind that is to really emphasize R.K. Maroon as a total huckster. Like, I think to push home the idea that he's this, like, corrupt studio head, that he's just churning out crap. And he knows it.
And that might be it. It might just be crap.
But I want to say one thing about that cartoon, though. The transition from that being an actual cartoon you're watching to a live set that looks like
a cartoon is fantastic.
Oh, my God. But it's dizzying.
And yet that's the moment that contradicts that, because I've always wanted to think that too. Oh, hey, maybe this is, I want to forgive it and say that they're making crap. But the director is so pissed off because Roger has done this 23 times and still can't get the stars.
And that's the great joke about that, is like, it doesn't fucking matter at all if it's stars or if it's birds. And they keep making him go through this entire fucking gauntlet of pain just to get that right. Like, that is, to me, such a great joke, where it's like, ah, damn it, it's birds again. Why isn't it stars? And it's like, what the fuck does that even matter at all? We're going to make him run through and get beat. And they're all mad at him, the one who's taking all the punishment 23 times. So I kind of like that joke. And yeah, that joke doesn't work if we hadn't just watched him go through all of this fucking ridiculous passion of the rabbit situation. I also wanted to note real quickly about Kathleen Turner, uncredited as Jessica Rabbit.
Yeah.
And
that surprised me when I was watching the credits.
No
today.
Real reason why. Like, there's no, like, Kathleen Turner's never talked about it. Zemeckis has never talked about it. There's never a concrete reason given. Maybe it was for Mystique. Maybe it's the fact that Amy Irving did her singing voice. I don't know. But it's really interesting. And also interesting in this movie, and I've already mentioned him once, the thing that haunted my nightmares most about Who Framed Roger Rabbit was, of course, Judge Doom, played so beautifully by Christopher Lloyd.
Oh yeah.
You want to talk again about an actor who, this is one of their best roles ever, I think. Christopher Lloyd will always be remembered as Doc from Back to the Future, for sure. That's his top role. Right next to it, in my opinion, though, is Judge Doom.
And if you want to take these two brilliant things and put them together, watch the way that Cundy shoots.
Yeah. Doom.
He shoots up at him.
Yeah.
He's always towering over you.
He makes him look 8 feet tall.
Yes.
Yeah.
He's always, you know, he's always got that until kind of the end of the movie when we're removing the threat. But yeah, there are all these shots. He walks into frame with the camera looking up at him.
Also, really subtle detail. There's never wind in this movie, but every time he's around, his cape kind of flaps there's a breeze.
Because he's a cartoon character.
It's so fucking cool.
It's the hint.
Also, a tidbit that was added by Christopher Lloyd was, he compared the part of Doom to his role as the Klingon commander Krug in
Part 6
in Star Trek 3.
Oh, 3.
And so one of the things he did in this movie is he avoid blinking while on camera. Judge Doom never blinks. That's so off-putting that because they're fake eyes. Well, yes, that obviously. But do you know who was originally auditioned for the role and was turned down because producers found him too terrifying? Tim Curry. Tim Curry,
of course,
originally auditioned.
Oh my God. You know what? As much as I love Lloyd, that's an alternate universe version I want to watch. I want to watch Tim Curry as Doom.
Yeah. Oh my. Yeah. No,
Judge Doom. Yeah.
That's I would pay all of the money to see that happen.
That's actually an alternate universe I'd watch.
Then there are some odder choices that before Christopher Lloyd, they were thinking John Cleese, Roddy McDowell, not Malcolm McDowell. You got a villain role and you go Roddy McDowell. That's interesting. Eddie Deason and Sting were all apparently considered for the role of Judge Doom. And to our 80s all over pals, Scott and Drew, I can only say, Wow.
Wow.
That is fucking...
Wow.
Wow. It's fucking creepy. Like, I don't... Like, but it's creepy in a different way.
Dabney Coleman is first rate.
Dabney Coleman was not considered for this role, but he is, in fact, first rate. So, yeah. A lot of weird, almost... Like, a lot of weird parallel dimensions.
We haven't mentioned that in a while. By the way, go listen to 80s All Over, guys.
Do it.
Do it.
Do it. Yeah, no. So, but the moment where, and I'm jumping around, but you guys, I'm assuming if you're listening to this podcast, and even if you're not, like, I'm assuming most people have seen Who Framed Roger Rabbit. It was so ubiquitous in the late 80s, early 90s. It was at, like, the toys, like the marketing, but this movie was a huge fucking smash.
Oh God. No, this was one of those movies. This was like we talked about last week with Young Guns. Young Guns was the movie that was really kind of setting the pop culture on fire for that summer in terms of being the hip thing. This was the big mainstream thing. Like, this was, oh my God, this is incredible. But of course, again, this is the end of the 80s. It is the very end of this 80s era. We are watching, as I've talked about before, we have shifted over into most of our films. Most of the big movies of 1988 are rooted in reality. They are more raw realism than they are fantasy, as we had in the early 80s. And it's that last gasp of nostalgia before we stop being nostalgic for these things.
Yeah.
In fact, like when Pulp Fiction would come out 6 years later, its main criticism, like as much as it melted brains and everyone was in love with it, the big criticism people had for it is that, you know, some of the plots in it were these cliched 1930s noir plots that this Quentin Tarantino guy was just stealing whole hog and adding clever dialogue into. And because by that point, the idea of nostalgia was considered absurd. We did not feel nostalgic for this stuff anymore. Nostalgia is a product of the 80s, and it ain't the 80s anymore, pals. It's the 90s. But this is that last gasp of nostalgia, in the same way that that's exactly how Ready Player One feels, where Ready Player One is like, oh, this is the end of this era. This is the last time we're going to look back at the 80s like this and look back at these, you know, things like this with through this lens and feel this nostalgia. And 5-10 years from now, the idea of making a movie around nostalgia is going to seem silly and trite.
Right.
And then sure enough, 30 years from now, people are going to be fucking eating it up with a spoon again. You know, it's going to be 2048 and people are going to be like, oh my God, the teens were so cool. We had Marvel movies coming out every other week. And why they just don't make movies like that anymore.
They just don't make 10 years worth of cinematic universes like that anymore.
Yeah. I mean, that's that. It's the circle of life, my friends. You are going to go through it. Those of you youngins who are listening to this show are going to look back. Old man Cargill's going to be in his rocking chair. That old man Cargill. We'll be decrepit old man Cargill, rocking back and forth going, I fucking told you, whippersnappers.
He just keeps keeping that crypt.
It'll be the fucking crypt keeper in 30 years, my friends. This beard's going to be the only thing that's going to swing lower than this beard be my balls.
And there it is.
There it is.
It's like you're in the crazy cab. And you realize the cab is the thing steering and you have no control whatsoever.
Crazy taxi.
That's where I... Yeah, okay. So I want to go back. I know, great place to just forget any of that happened and go back for a second to Dean Cundey. The only Oscar he's ever won, and that's a fucking travesty that he's only won one Oscar, Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Yeah.
And he's actually worked with Zemeckis more than he has with John Carpenter, despite the fact that most people remember him as a John Carpenter.
No. Most people don't remember him as a John Carpenter. You remember him as a John Carpenter.
Really?
Yeah.
You don't think most people remember that Dean Cundey shot all of John Carpenter's best movies?
No. I think they remember that, but that was kind of earlier in his career, whereas he has since gone on to do so many bigger things that have left much bigger craters in the pop culture. Because keep in mind, even to this day, if you talk to John Carpenter about how his films are viewed, he kind of growls and grumbles and wishes people had appreciated them 30 fucking years ago.
Yeah.
40 fucking years ago in some cases. As much as we here at Junk Food Cinema fucking love the living shit out of pretty much everything John Carpenter's ever done, up until the late 90s. it is, you know, Kundi has gone on to do so many big things that it is shocking. This is the only Academy Award he's got.
I think so, too. I will say that he sums up this movie, I think, better than an hour of us kind of making jokes ever could, because he said, Roger Rabbit was about all of the right people being at the right place at the right time. We were all off on this journey together. It wasn't like one person directing and dragging a lot of people along. We really embraced the project as groundbreaking and understood that we were going to be doing things that hadn't been done before, that we were going to be finding ways to do them. So, like, yeah, that's exactly what this movie is. It's the thing that we've talked about before with other projects where you just, everything comes together exactly as it should. You know, the actors that you're pursuing that you think are going to be the best for this role either say no, or you can't get a hold of them, or they're Eddie Deason, and you and you end up with the right assortment of people. In fact, Robert Zemeckis almost didn't direct this. Originally, they wanted Terry Gilliam to direct.
He was one of the many that they approached,
which kind of makes sense considering
it makes a lot of sense
considering how much animation goes into, like, if you watch Monty Python's Flying Circus and
by the way, take a quick trip to the sidebar.
You're gonna pause now.
Okay, so there are two things to talk about in terms of Terry Gilliam. One, you mentioned his animation, and there is, I want you guys, when you're done with this, I want you to go and Google how to make animation with Terry Gilliam. In the 70s, Terry Gilliam appeared on some show, and I don't even know what it was, but he spent 15 minutes doing an interview about how he made the cutout animation for Monty Python, and he actually shows you the process and makes it before your very eyes, and it is fascinating to see, and it is something any Monty Python fan or any animation fan should watch. Young Terry Gilliam having a good time and explaining how he does cutout animation, one of the best things I've watched on the internet in the last year. So go seek that out. Secondly, he makes so much sense going back into the vault as a junk food alum. There is no other director aside from Zemeckis that was so good in the 80s at making absurd family films.
That's true.
I mean, when you're thinking about something that wrestles, that straddles the line between family film and adult film, fucking Time Bandits is right fucking there.
Yeah. And also, I would throw out that The Adventures of Baron Munchausen is like a live action cartoon.
It is.
So much of that movie is just a cartoon brought to life.
Just imagine, though, the alternate universe where Terry Gilliam decided to make Who Framed Roger Rabbit instead of The Adventures of Baron Munchausen.
Yeah.
Where that's what happened to his career.
That's fascinating to think about, for sure. Also,
so now, we're done with the sidebar, right?
Oh, I'm sorry, coming back. There it is. And also, I want to talk about, you know, something else that's very fascinating in the realm of alternate universes was the proposed sequel to Who Framed Roger Rabbit, which was, in fact, a prequel entitled Roger Rabbit, the Toon Patrol. And just fucking listen to this. This is amazing. It was set before the original film and started with Roger's early life on a farm in the Midwest before he sets out to find his parents, joining the army and meeting his future wife, Jessica, who he has to rescue from the Nazis, ending with Roger discovering that his father is really Bugs Bunny. That was the proposed sequel to this movie. And again, we have Bugs Bunny sharing the screen with Mickey Mouse because that was the deal. It's like, it's going to cost you $5,000 per character you use in this movie, which if you look at all the characters in this movie, they spent a lot of money. And they had really, like, we talked about that dueling piano scene. It was apparently in the contract that a lawyer had to draw this up. And I just imagine this lawyer sitting there going, I went to law school so I could put as a writer in a contract that Donald Duck and Daffy Duck have to appear equally talented at playing the piano or I walk.
By the way, having interacted with a bunch of Hollywood lawyers, they live for that shit. The very fact, dude, you're never going to believe what I got to put in a contract today.
I feel like
that is, this is some of the shit some of these guys live for. They, as much as people like to talk about how awful lawyers are, entertainment lawyers are probably some of the coolest fucking assholes you will ever meet. Cause they will be, cause you want them to be assholes cause they will be the asshole that you're not allowed to be.
Right.
But they are also pretty cool fucking guys that are like, dude, this is going to be fun.
I am shocked that there's not a podcast called Hollywood Lawyers that's just stories like this from actual Hollywood lawyers.
Yeah, like, no, that would actually be...
I would listen to that all day or day. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, no, there's... That actually would be kind of amazing.
Get this straight, Meatball. I don't work for Tones.
So we haven't really gotten into the plot necessarily, because what's interesting is that the plot does go to some very... Like, we talked about whether or not this is a kid's movie, and I always have kind of a two-pronged approach to that. Well, three. One is, I don't give a shit. I don't give a shit whether it is or if a child can enjoy something about it, and it's not something wholly inappropriate for them to be watching, anything can really be a kid's movie. Like, I think we're both living proof of that. However...
Anything can be a kid's movie if you don't mind the amount of damage you do.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that's...
Let's not tell my wife that I have that ideology, but it's true. But what I think is interesting...
She knows.
What I think is interesting is that not only do you have a lot of references to the seedier things, the murder, the sex of you know, hard-boiled detective stories, you also have an intricate plot about creating the country's first freeway system and subverting public transportation.
Yeah.
Like the kids love. Like, it is the trade dispute of Toontown. Like, it is really getting into the minutiae of public works.
Well, but that's the beauty of it, is that it does this really great job of being nostalgic for an LA that was, and then mocking the LA it became.
True story.
That is very much part and parcel of what this movie is. It is pining for the LA that Zemeckis clearly is still in love with, and that Spielberg was in love with, and the only way Spielberg could love Los Angeles more in his films is if World War II had happened there. Like, that is literally like, if the Nazis had landed and there had been fights in LA, like, that would just be, you know, that would be how Steven Spielberg sexually identified. Like, but it is really interesting how they do that. What I love about this movie in terms of that plot is the plot of this movie is cliched as fuck, but it is also so elegantly structured. There is not a single plot element of this movie that is wasted.
True.
It is full of buried guns. Every element that begins early in the story ends up tying up later. There are no real loose ends. Everything falls together in the way a classic Chandler-esque story does. The whole concept of the old noirish Chandler story was you have a detective who's on two different cases, and the two different cases end up being the same case. And here he's not on two cases, he's on one case, but the other thing going on in his life is all the people around him keep, you know, are dealing with the fact that there's this company buying up all this shit. Mm-hmm. And as it turns out, that company is controlled by the judge, and everything he's dealing with ties in here. You know, the love letter that Roger Rabbit writes is on the will, you know, the ink, the disappearing, reappearing ink, like, everything in this movie falls into line the way a good Chandler noir falls into line. So it becomes not a cliche, but a love letter, if you'll pardon the use of that again.
One thousand times, I will forgive that.
To this type of story. So not only, and that's why I really kind of feel like this is the spiritual predecessor to Ready Player One, is that this movie is not just nostalgic for the cartoons of the creator's youth. It is also nostalgic for a type of story Hollywood couldn't tell anymore. That these noir stories, the stories of these detectives, the idea of a detective in 1940s LA, and, you know, he used to be on the force and now he's a private eye, but he's down and out and he's a drunk. You know, these are the type of stories that in the late 80s you couldn't tell anymore. Like, in the same summer as this happens, we have John McClane, and John McClane is the modern,
analog
to this Valiant, Eddie Valiant. Like, that's how drastic the characters had changed over the course of 40 years. And so this movie's being nostalgic for that in that way, and also getting it 100% right. Yeah. Like, it so gets the noir right, that the only thing that's very different to it is how the movie ends, because the movie ends in such a wonderfully elegant way in which it ceases to be a noir and becomes a cartoon.
Yeah, and you're right. I mean, could this plot be any more Chandler-like? I don't think so.
No. No.
I said
no.
It. I said it.
No.
I'm proud of it. I'm sticking by it.
No.
We gotta pause for just a second.
Don't be Monica.
You're gonna pause now. We gotta go back to the opening of this movie and that cartoon that we're watching being filmed that you and I were just talking about. That director is so involved and is yelling. We missed who plays that director. We missed it entirely. It was right in front of us. You want to talk about buried guns? How about buried lines of cocaine? That's Joel fucking Silver.
Who?
Joel. I'm sorry. It's Joel goddamn Silver. I want birds. Fuck your. No. I don't want birds. I want fucking stars. Fuck your birds. I want stars. Give me stars. That's why he's yelling the entire time.
No. In fact, that seems to be him stone cold sober.
Joel, come on. Joel Silver's the director of that cartoon.
Yes, he is.
And we just totally fucking missed it.
We have not gotten into all the cameos and weird, you know, weird things in this movie because there's so much of it. Like, this movie is just like this, frankly, because I felt that, you know, the reason why we missed Joel Silver, I wanted to talk about Tar Baby instead. I wanted to be slightly more offensive.
Well, you know what?
Than a Hollywood pariah. A guy who now is a Hollywood pariah.
Mission accomplished. And also, I want to talk, we talked about the ending of this movie and that when all the curtains are pulled back and we realize that Judge Doom has been playing everyone from the beginning. And before we even get to the big reveal about Judge Doom, can we talk about the fact that part of his plan involves horrific genocide? He's planning to roll into Toontown with a dip sprayer and melt all the cartoon characters to ash. Like, that's fucked up. Like,
yes,
I keep asking, because, and I'm asking this question because I watched this movie the way you watched Young Guns. I watched Who Framed Roger Rabbit pretty much every other day on VHS. I loved this movie. I had a Roger Rabbit doll that was my favorite stuffed animal. And the more I think about this movie, the more I watch it as an adult, I really should not have been into this movie as a kid.
But that's why, this is exactly why I feel like the sanitization of Hollywood family films is actually bad for us. Because the thing is we grew up on these films, and these films did not distort us. You and I are both happily married, normal family men that for fun, normal, we sit down and have, you say, for fun, what do? We sit down, we have a couple beers together and we talk about a 30-year-old movie. Yeah. That's what we do for a good time. Like, this is, these, you know, we had movies where our characters sweared, so be it. We had movies where the villains did awful things and that our heroes then responded to those awful things in light. You know, the thing is that kids, we're telling kids that this movie might be a little too adult for them. And then they go on Twitter and they see mass shootings. Like, the world is so much more fucked up than Roger Rabbit ever could be.
And I agree with that. But two things. One, when I was a kid, we didn't have Twitter. And secondly, I got this same lecture from Chris Cox about Beetlejuice. And I get what you're saying, but there's a difference between, like,
that's
villains.
The second time you said Beetlejuice this episode.
I know. I got to be careful. The thing is, like, I get that villains do bad things and our family members shouldn't be sanitized, but there's villains doing bad things, and then there's a villain who specifically wants to take every character you've ever loved as a child and melt them. Well, like, we are dealing with a next level of fucked up-tism in this movie.
Which is also awesome because it's also about killing your childhood. Like, yes. It's entirely what he's doing is about killing your childhood. Still, while that plan is fucked up, we watch him murder a shoe for no other reason than to show what the dip does.
I will never get that out of my head. Like, that haunts me.
The way it screams.
I don't like it.
If you want to talk about the most disturbing part of that, his plan is not it. Watching that adorable little shoe that cuddles up to him fucking get melted is probably the most awful part of that movie in terms of what it does.
And second on that list of things that will scar me forever is when Eddie manages to run him over with a steamroller only to reveal that Judge Doom was a toon the entire time. And that image of him getting up flat, I don't, like, there is a combination of animation styles going on for that. And he makes this weird little, like, cooing sound as he's jumping around all flat.
And then when he starts like inflating himself with air, and it looks like a John Carpenter movie, all of a sudden you realize
fucking intense.
That's where the Carpenter Kundi comes in.
Yes.
Because it's like, ooh.
Yeah.
Like, to this day, it's kind of skin crawlingly creepy.
I just can't even. It just, it, and the, ah. But that whole finale is so good. at the Acme factory because I grew up watching Looney Tunes and Acme was the company.
Oh yeah.
The company where Bugs Bunny and the Coyote would get all of their gags, all of their gadgets would come from Acme. And I used to joke as a kid, like, why does the Coyote keep buying shit from Acme when it never works? He's like, he's buying things from a company that sells faulty goods.
I have a suggestion for you, by the way. Something I wanted to bring up.
Look, if you're just going to tell me to go fuck myself again, then, you know, I've heard suggestion before.
That's not just a suggestion. That's a life choice. There is this great role-playing game that was put out in the late 80s, early 90s by Steve Jackson Games.
Okay.
Which is based here in Austin, Texas. It's called Tune.
I'm listening.
And it is a role-playing game where you play a cartoon character inserted into cartoons. And it is very much the most Roger Rabbit thing you can ever do. And it's also a really great way for those of you who have young kids and you want to get them into role playing. It is one of those great games of let's play Tune and you have them make their cartoon character. And if you have any artistic ability, you draw the cartoon character or use online creators and such. And then you run through the various tunes that have plots and, you know, they have the cartoon physics, and the cartoon physics feel very much like this final scene in Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
They're breaking open portable holes and mallets with boxing gloves and singing swords and just watching.
The singing sword, by the way, is the single most on point. That this gets in terms of getting the old feel of the cartoons right. Is one of the things with Roger Rabbit is that while it has nostalgia through the 80s lens. Mm-hmm. And so the comedy of these characters is very 80s and not very 40s and 50s. It's not very 1948. That singing sword is the most on point to the cartoons that it's making, that it's kind of reliving. It's the one gag where it's like, that feels like the era. That is exactly the type of joke that would totally fly in that point. And I honestly think it's one of the best jokes in the movie.
It's a pun, which the Acme cartoons were, the Warner Brothers Looney Tunes cartoons were full of. And it's a knock at a celebrity, which again, the Looney Tunes loved it. Looney Tunes did whole episodes where they would go to the Brown Derby and it would just be, there's Laurel and Hardy, there's Humphrey Bogart, there's
James Cagney was a favorite.
James Cagney, Audrey Hepburn, Mae West.
Oh, like, they loved Mae West.
This movie loves Mae West. Let's be real. But it also reminds me now too, because we talked about the Beetlejuice cartoon. Fuck, I said it three times.
It's showtime.
And how it was just a pun delivery system, and I'm like, no, that's very much Looney Tunes as well. Also, Cargill, I just realized that we said something that was completely false.
Good.
We said the Jim Crow Crows are not in this movie. They are. I just realized they are. They're her backup band. When she's singing the song at the Ink and Paint Club, they are her backup band.
I
just, like, it just hit me as we were talking, like, holy shit, they didn't shy away from that one either. They're in this movie too. That's kind of fucking crazy. And it was the Sinatra thing that was like Sinatra's backup band. Oh my God, the backup band is, that's fucking crazy. But watching Christopher Lloyd and Bob Hoskins play in throughout this like climactic battle, they are just playing in this scenery and really like going full force with it. And I love watching, like, it's my favorite part of this entire movie to this day is just watching the two of them get to be cartoon characters in the real world.
Yeah.
And that actually brings me to my next point is we need to talk about the deleted scene, the famous Roger Rabbit deleted scene.
I don't know this.
You don't know this. Okay. So there is a scene that's even in the trailer for the movie where Bob Hoskins breaks back into Jessica Rabbit's dressing room to try and find the will. And he gets punched by Mongo, the big bouncer ape that he has a conflict with at the beginning.
You call him Chump, Chimp.
Nice monkey suit.
Wise ass.
He gets knocked out, and when he wakes up, Jessica Rabbit is there, and so is Judge Doom. And he's like, you know, you were told to stop snooping around, blah, 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 blah. And he's like, there is no will. And he's like, no, there is a will, and I'll find it. And he goes, well, maybe we should go downtown. And Eddie Valiant's like, great, we'll talk to Officer Santino. That's a great idea. And Doom's like, no, the other downtown. And the Weasels kidnap him and take him into Toontown. and you see them doing something, and they walk out of that tunnel.
That's more than deleted scene.
Oh, it's a whole thing. And they walk out of that tunnel, and they're carrying paintbrushes and rollers and all this stuff, and they're like, I always thought he was pigheaded. By the way, the guy who does the main weasel is Squiggy from Laverne and Shirley.
Oh, yeah.
Which is so fucking weird. And I had toys of the weasels, too, as a kid. That's so bizarre. So they're walking out. They're like, I think now he gets the point that he's pigheaded. And he walks out, and he's got this burlap. They throw him out of the tunnel. Like, whoever the stuntman is must have been on a 10-foot platform when he jumped off of it and landed on concrete. It's amazing. And he takes the burlap sack off, and they have painted an animated pig head on top of Eddie Valiant's head. And he's looking out through the mouth. And he's just like, oh, no, I've been toonarooed. And he starts screaming and running through the streets. And then he goes to his office, and he washes it off with turpentine. And you watch this pig face kind of like Hitchcock style swirl around the drain and go down. And that's why when Jessica Rabbit shows up at his office, he's walking out of the bathroom with no shirt on. Because that's what happened immediately before that they cut out. And it's in the trailer. And it's a really bizarre but still kind of amazing scene that apparently was the first finished effects of the entire movie that they had done. And then they ended up cutting the scene because they thought it kind of ground everything to a halt. But yeah. You should, it's online.
And also being a Spielberg production kind of goes back to, has a weird connection to Poltergeist.
This is very true. Very, very true. But yeah, I would
in highly, the worst way possible.
Highly recommend going back and watching that scene because it is long and it's interesting. And it's weird to think that they shot all of that first and had that finished first and then decided to cut it out. But it is kind of the stuff of legends, that scene. Overall, I think Who Framed Roger Rabbit is such a great mix of... It's something they didn't think they'd ever be able to do with bringing all these characters together, much like Ready Player One, much like Infinity War. But it also is nostalgic both for the cartoons of the era, the detective stories of the era, and I think it walks a really great balance between the drama, between the heavy stuff, and between the comedy. I mean, the scene where Eddie's talking about his brother's death, or the scene where he's going through photographs and finds pictures of his brother, are heartbreaking.
Well, like I said, I think structurally this movie's perfect. Like yeah. Every bit of information. In fact, the only thing I don't think this movie needs, and I get it for kids, because kids need it. But if it were an adult film and not for kids, mm-hmm. I don't think you'd need the scene in which Eddie explains what happened to his brother.
Yeah.
To Roger. Like that, we already get it because they've laid all the track for it and done it very well. And the exposition of this film is so well done. The guns are so well buried. They all get pulled out at just the right moment, and it makes for such a satisfying conclusion. And it's just a really great movie.
And it ends with this perfectly uplifting song, Smile, Donya, Smile. And they just walk out with all the cartoon characters. It's like, it's the sweetest ending to a movie where the villain was literally
melted. like, he was crushed and then melted. Yeah.
What was he? A rubber mask? That's a great line.
And then, of course, it ends exactly the way it needs to with
Porky Pig.
With Porky Pig, who that's all, folks. And then who closes the hole? Tinkerbell.
Yeah.
So we get that merging.
You can't have one without the other.
Legally.
Oh, God. No. I've been doing a rude.
And that brings us to the junk food pairing. And I think this was a pretty easy one.
Yeah.
You got to go with the chip and dip situation. So chips and dip, especially if that dip, because the more I looked at it, the more it would like spill on the ground or you would see it in the barrel. It's very, very green. So I think a good salsa verde would be a great dip for your chips and dip as you enjoy Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
I think you watch Roger Rabbit the Eddie Valiant way and just keep drinking whiskey.
Yeah.
Until everything looks like a cartoon or nothing does.
Okay, but you've got to stop advocating for that every day of our lives. I mean, I get
Look,
it.
I'm just
but
telling
I,
you, whiskey pairs well with whiskey and occasionally a side of whiskey and a movie.
Didn't you used to be C. Robert Cargill, or did you change your name to Jack Daniels? Guys, thank you so much for joining us on this episode. I'm so happy we got to talk about this movie. I love it so much. It was such an integral part of my childhood, and I'm glad that we've covered it because one of the best movies of the summer of '88. And just an absolute blast. If you haven't seen it, I can't imagine that there are too many of you listening that haven't seen it, but if you haven't, go and seek it out immediately. And if you want to seek out more of us, you can always go to Blog Talk Radio as well as iTunes and find our entire back catalog. You can find us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. And of course, you can like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema.
.com.
You can support us on Patreon, patreon.com. God damn it. /junkfoodcinema. For as little as $1 an episode, you get access to bonus content nobody else gets to hear. And we will be at Denver Comic Con June 15th through the 17th doing a live show I'm super excited about. I've never been to Denver, and the way this show is shaping up, I couldn't be happier. So get your tickets now. Very excited about that. I think we're going to be Friday night is what I'm hearing is when our show is going to be on. So keep that in mind if you're buying day passes. There's plenty of other great stuff at Denver Comic Con, but if you happen to just be coming for us, we will be doing our show on Friday night. Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me on Instagram and Twitter at Massawyrm, M-A-S-S-A-W-Y-R-M. And you can find my new book in stores, wherever you buy books. We Are Where the Nightmares Go, on in hardback and in audio, also ebooks. So wherever you buy your books, you can find it right now. So please, it's 10 horror stories that range from the humorous to the absurd to the terrifying. And I hope you find a story or two in there that you love.
Awesome. Check that out, you guys. And until next time, I just want to say, smile, darn you, smile. And is that a loaf of crazy bread in your pocket, or are you just happy to see me?